Hi, you're listening to Impact, Diálogos, a podcast on Brazilian contemporary politics, populism, and conspiracy theory. I am Caterina Hadzikidi, and I'm your host. In this episode, I speak with Letícia Cesarino. Letícia is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the Federal University of Santa Catarina in Florianópolis, Brazil. She holds a PhD from the University of California at Berkeley and is currently working on the contemporary co-emergencies between digital media, populist politics, post-truth, and neoliberal rationalities. In this episode of Impact Diálogos, Letícia will speak about her digital ethnographic work on Bolsonarism, populism, and conspiracy theories. Letícia has proposed the term digital populism to describe the watershed phenomenon that enabled a digitally mediated construction of political hegemony. Analyzing digital content circulating in pro-Bolsonaro WhatsApp groups, she suggested that the friend-enemy binary structured the logic of Bolsonaro's 2018 presidential campaign. I asked her to tell me more about the concept of digital populism, about who or what was the enemy for Bolsonaro supporters, and what did this enemy represent.
I use the term digital populism to talk about this structural convergence between the dynamics of populist mobilization and the dynamics of digital media. By populism here, I mean basically Ernesto Laclau's structural theory of populism in the book On Populist Reason. And on this book, he describes populism as a kind of discourse that creates this public called the people around this figure of the leader. And it has two main discursive axes. One is the building of equivalence between leader and people. And the other one is articulated with the first, the building of difference between this leader people group, which are the friends, and some kind of enemy. One of the interesting things about populist mobilization through digital media is how this whole mechanics gets to unfold in a sort of fractal topology, meaning that it is at the same time unitary, so it's the same leader and the same enemy, but in practice it unfolds at different scales in slightly different ways. So that happens with the enemy here. So at a higher level of equivalence building, this enemy revolved around empty signifiers like the left, communism, corruption, gender ideology, identity politics, globalism, and several signifiers that were actually very common among the alt-right and other movements like that as well. But in practice, meaning in terms of the different segments of the population and ultimately even in terms of particular individuals that were accessing this discourse that was circulating in social media and WhatsApp, one of the things I realized was that each person would understand and appropriate this discourse in their own way. So Bolsonaro, communism, the nation would mean slightly different things for different users. Pre-digital populism was about that as well, but one of the things I found interesting in the Brazilian case is how this kind of kaleidoscopic structure with its implicit segmentation of publics, which converges a lot with how the internet works today, especially segmented marketing, right? It was already embedded in the design of the memes. I analyzed especially the memes, right? The images that circulated. So it was very interesting to notice how these different publics and different enemies were already embedded in the design. So there were memes for all different sorts of potential publics, and some of them very different. For instance, the typical Bolsonarist macho guy who wants guns and hates gays, and a very different kind of voter. Like my mom, for instance, was a very peaceful person and who was looking in for this figure of a father that would take care of the people, that would discipline. I mean, the point of the kaleidoscopic figure here is to show how the digital architecture allows for Bolsonaro being one and many at the same time, and the enemy as well.
Letícia has written that she began her digital ethnography as a matter of personal urgency when a close relative of hers disclosed her intention to vote for Bolsonaro. Her experience adds to those of many Brazilians who had to come to grips with the fact that one or more members of their family declared an unexpected support for the far-right candidate. I asked Letícia to tell me why, in her view, voting became such a divisive issue in 2018.
So there are many dimensions to this, but one I think speaks more closely to the digital populism kind of analysis relates to how social media and digital architectures in the platformized internet of today collapses what were previously different contexts, especially the difference between public and private domains in our lives. So politics used to be a very public, impersonal, at least the normative view of it would revolve around this difference between public and private. And the internet really muddles this and makes this very confusing. And Bolsonaro was very intelligent, really, his campaign in taking advantage of this ambiguity. So what happened there, I think, was that the digital mediations really allowed to collapse these contexts and cut across old lines, right? Especially related to the left and right spectrum. It provided a new language for the right that made it very personal, very moralizing. And it's entirely different from anything that came before in terms of what we know as the political right in Brazil. The way I see it, it's interesting how this new right and Bolsonaro as a leader in this emerging political identity makes their own version of how the personal has become political. The left began with this previously in a different way, but the right also does that, but through this more antagonistic and divisive way. So it contaminates private relations, this dynamics that I described as digital populism, in a way that some people began to see the enemy within their own families. These fights that were very common between fathers and daughters and sons and cousins, especially across generations, but not only. It's, in my view, one effect of this personalization of politics that has been very much afforded by the way digital media collapses context, especially between public and private domains, as part of the literature on new media has diagnosed.
WhatsApp was an essential channel for digital populism in the last presidential campaign, in large part because of its widespread use among the population. My question to Letícia was whether the social media and messaging apps landscape has changed since, and if so, in what ways?
Yes, it did change, and it changed in interesting ways. So in 2018, it was a dynamic anchored on WhatsApp, but also including Facebook and other social media platforms as well. So the point there was that this populist mechanics was to make the group grow. Bolsonaro was able to grow its base and embrace a lot of different segments of the population, like on the political right, like the Lavajatistas, anti-corruption, anti-workers party movements that were not necessarily from the conservative right that Bolsonaro really represents. So, and it was even able to embrace more ambiguous kinds of voters that were not even left nor right, but it was able to throw this very wide net, right, the kind of discourse he circulated during the campaign in 2018. So as he took office in 2019, something interesting happened. It was almost as if the same populist mechanics was turned inwards. So Bolsonarism in government started to shed some of its outer layers, right? So part of the military eventually left. The Lavajatistas and Sergio Moro, the Minister of Justice, eventually left in the beginning of last year, and other allies, right, that were together with him in 2018, that didn't really comply to the core of Bolsonarism, which is very conservative, very militarized. So they eventually left, and the strictly Bolsonarist digital landscape actually shrank around late 2019, early 2020. And now it began to grow again during the pandemic, but in a more ambiguous and different way. The figure of the enemy, for instance, is not that much important. It's still there, but what I notice is more common is how he tries to keep the level of informational ambiguity very high. So he's been doing now during the pandemic what I call discursive hedging, because he plays narratively in very different fronts about the vaccine, around the virus, around the measures to treat and prevent the vaccine. So he's very contradictory sometimes. He keeps this informational environment very chaotic. He has a lot of leverage to escape responsibilization for the 200,000 deaths that we see and counting. And at the same time, he is occasionally able to take credit for things that he didn't do.
Several fake news stories and conspiracy theories circulated on pro-Bolsonaro WhatsApp groups during the 2018 presidential campaign. I asked Leticia to mention some of the most influential ones.
Yeah, there were many, many and multiple and very different, targeted to different publics, right, as I mentioned. But perhaps I could talk about some of the really broadest and most popular ones at the time. So maybe the first one was the gay kit. It's not exactly a conspiracy theory, but it's a lie that became truth for his followers, or a frame through which people came to see what the left was, what the actions of the left were, and what the left would do should they gain the elections. So the gay kit was basically an empty signifier that convinced people that if the left or the workers' party won the election, they would implement what they call gender ideology policies, that children would be taught to choose their own gender and would be taught about sex and masturbation in schools, things like that. So that was very, very influential, and it drew a lot of people who are not necessarily right-wing, but who were concerned about the sexualization of children and all that. A second one I would underscore was in the aftermath of the knife attack that he suffered in early September. So a lot of conspiratorial narratives circulated around that as well, that the guy who stabbed him was paid by the Workers' Party, or that were international, some kind of international influence around that as well, and especially the notion that that could happen again. So the enemy in this more conspiratorial kind of narratives was very important that it should act as an imminent threat. So it's not just that this enemy exists, that is about to do something that would ruin Brazil. And then a third one that I found very interesting, and just a few days from the final voting, the narrative shifted towards posing the electoral system itself as a threat. So these were the narratives about voting fraud, that the election would be stolen, that the electronic ballots were controlled by Venezuela, or, you know, whatever. There was several versions of this, but the interesting thing is that the performative effect of these narratives was that they created, on the eve of the election, this atmosphere of imminent threat and danger that the voters should be alert against, and they were urged to film the ballots and do things like that. So the point was really to keep people mobilized to the very end. And that was the main function, as it were, of these conspiratorial narratives during the campaign.
Despite the polysemy of the term populism, populist leaders are commonly understood to divide the population between the good and moral people and the evil and unscrupulous elites. Conspiracy theorists similarly construe a worldview where powerful and immoral elites are conniving to protect their interests against those of the unsuspecting population. I asked Leticia In what ways, if at all, populism and conspiracy theories come together in the official and unofficial digital campaign content she analyzed?
I find this convergence and these analogies between the dynamics of populist mobilization and conspiratorial thinking and theories online very interesting, because on the one hand, there is this convergence of actual content, right? So some of the narratives that Bolsonaro and the outright, for instance, used to mobilize are also present in conspiracy theories that don't necessarily have this political dimension as explicit. For instance, all the talk about globalism, about the New World Order, about George Soros and his ties with whatever, you know, China or global communism. Brazil has its own version of deep state theories as well. So the contents repeat, but also what I found interesting was that the mechanics is very similar at some points, especially the kind of inversions that both populist mobilization and conspiracy theories realize they do, right? When people get into that framing, usually it's a kind of conversion. So in the case of Bolsonarism, for instance, Bolsonaro was showing them what real politics is and the whole political system that they were living in for the past 30 years. It was all a theater because everyone was from the same group, like the QAnon theories about Democrats and Republicans, for instance, that there was this a deal so they could run the country and pretend that they're political oppositions, but in fact, they were one big system, and Bolsonaro was the guy that was coming from outside of the system to purify the country from its corruption, etc. These inversions happen as this conversion happened, right? The red pill, as people sometimes would call it in internet cultures. When people are red pilled, they come to see what was truth as lies, as deceit. So people become elite. And there are all these sorts of inversions that happen in both cases, both populism and conspiracy theories.
In her work, Leticia discusses the apparent paradox of Bolsonaro's campaign attracting women voters shortly after the massive nationwide anti-Bolsonaro street demonstrations that had a feminist articulation using the hashtag Ele Não, Not Him. She has described this as a process of displacement of the friend-enemy line within the female population, creating a sharp division between left-wing and right-wing women.
So it's the same mechanics, right? Left-wing women, feminists, and leftists. Women were portrayed as corrupt, as hypocritical, as a very explicit image-based kind of content that made people feel disgust and repulsion towards these women. So the feminists like peeing on the streets and walking around and protesting naked on the streets and association with notions of dirt. So very affect-based discourse there. And on the other hand, right-wing women were portrayed as the true feminists in a way, because they know how to do protests, they know how to think with their brains and not with their lower body parts and all these very recurrent, very repetitive themes at that moment. So I guess one of the effects was to make women who were still hesitant to embrace Bolsonaro's name because he had all this past history of misogynist statements, it provided them with very reasonable grammar that they could embrace and justify their new electoral choice.
Unlike what is sometimes assumed, Bolsonaro's electoral base is strikingly diverse, spanning regional, economic, and education group criteria. Leticia uses anthropologist Gregory Bateson's concept of seismogenesis to help explain the demographically diverse range of Bolsonaro's voters, which included Black, LGBTQI+, and women voters. I ask her how did symmetric seismogenesis play out in the run-up to the 2018 elections, and how did it account for the diversity of Bolsonaro's constituency?
What Bateson calls schismogenesis was a pattern of opposition that escalates. So one of the examples that he would give was the nuclear arms race. The Soviet bloc and the Western bloc were engaged in this very reciprocal and very relational kind of opposition, where the identity and the actions of one group was defined through the opposition to this other group. And then the tendency, as it gets very intense, is to escalate the opposition to a point where the opposition becomes about the relation itself and not as much about the content. I noticed something similar, very similar at certain moments during the campaign, and the aftermath of the Ele Não movement was one of those. So the Bolsonarist or the pro-Bolsonaro campaign at the time, the kind of content that they circulated was very explicit, how they use what I called a reverse mimesis. It's a sort of a design that uses the same form with reverse content. So for instance, that we use an image of a feminist woman with a mask, you know, naked, with colors denoting danger like black and red and smoke on the background. And then right next to it, a picture of another woman, a right-wing woman that was exactly the same, the same position, but with completely reverse content, with an angelical face holding a baby, with the Brazilian flags on the background, denoting an atmosphere of order, safety, hope. So this pattern was extremely recurrent in the content that was bulk message at that moment. So the hashtags, they were also reverse mimesis, right? So the Ele Não, not him hashtag that was used to convene the protests, his campaign put out yes him hashtag that was the opposite. So I think one of the effects of very strong focus on reverse mimesis at that moment was really to build this seismogenic opposition. And the hashtag fights in Twitter, for instance, is a very evident example of that, right? One hashtag begins, then the opposite comes, and then everyone wants to win. And so this escalates. So people are really encouraged to choose one side among two sides. Then that happened even before runoffs, when there were other candidates and options available. It became very dichotomous at that moment. And in my view, that has to do with this schismogenic dynamics that happens. So the identity of the new right at that moment and the identity of the left was very much one dependent on the other, but dependent and connected as opposition, not as identity. And then a final thing I would say about that is that it also had this characteristic of the content being very vague and even empty. So some of the arguments the Bolsonarists would use at the time was that if Globo, which is a mainstream news outlet in Brazil, they associate with the left, they would say, well, if Globo is saying something, no matter what it is, I am against it. Or if the Workers' Party is saying something, I'm against it. So it doesn't matter. The content, the political choice and the political identity is defined by the opposition as such, because in the attention economy, whatever engagement is engagement. It doesn't matter if it is positive, if it is negative. So at that moment, the left was actually very much enticed to campaign for him, but in this schismogenic and weird and inverted way.
Letícia mentioned earlier that as president, Bolsonaro is unwilling to take responsibility for his actions while trying to take credit for things he hasn't done. He also makes false allegations about the legitimacy of the electoral process, generating uncertainty and suspicion among voters. My question to Letícia was whether such actions coincide with a candidate profile that she analyzed and whether they raise or increase concerns about Bolsonaro's commitment to a liberal democratic project.
Yes, very clearly. I don't have any doubts that he doesn't have a commitment with liberal democracy as we know it, especially with the checks and balances part of it, right? It's very obvious how he would like, and he's very explicit about that, how he would like to exert some kind of direct rule. The thing is, he calls this democracy, and his followers accept that that's what they understand by democracy as well. So what I see there is a very interesting kind of encompassment of what Chantal Mouffe called the liberal institutional pole of democracy by the populist poll, right? Because she talks about modern liberal democracy as this arrangement between contradictory traditions, right? A more liberal institutional checks and balances one, and the one related to what she and Laclau call populist. Is the demos part, right? Is the popular sovereignty and popular will part. What the Bolsonaro's call democracy is basically just one of these poles, which is the leader that represents the majority, and then he will just rule according to the people's will. So there are no checks and balances in this arrangement. And at some points, Bolsonaro even put the other two branches of government explicitly as enemies, and his followers bought very much into that, which is the, of course, the Supreme Court and the National Congress, the legislative branch. Right now, he's trying to compromise a little bit, but he's still very ambiguous about seeing these checks and balances, right? The judiciary and the legislative as sometimes as enemies, sometimes as potential allies. So he does also have, in a way, a kind of external discourse, a kind of dog whistling for his loyal followers, where these institutions are still regarded as enemies. So, for instance, he claims that the Supreme Court won't let him do anything. He tries to take measures against the pandemic, and then the Supreme Court would just ban and overthrow his decisions, which is not exactly true. I mean, he could do a lot more than what he claims to be doing, but to his followers, he'll just say that they won't let him, right? The system won't let him. So the potential for, I don't want to say development of a fascist kind of government, but there is at least a sense in which he very clearly has no commitments with the sharing power part of liberal democracy, for sure.
Our conversation with Letícia took place before former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva regained his political rights and being eligible again to run for president in 2022. With this in mind, my final question to Letícia was about the ways in which digital electoral campaigns in 2022 may differ from those of 2018.
That's the question everyone is asking. So in the US, it turned out differently, right, in the case of Trump. But in the case of Brazil, nobody knows really. The kind of analysis that I think makes sense is to see that what Bolsonaro is trying to do is trying to keep and maintain around one third of the electorate as his base. And 2 years from now, he will try to do what he did in 2018, which is to escalate that into over 50%. Bolsonaro really thrives in this chaotic environment that Brazil is in today. So if things continue to be as they are today, I think the chances of him repeating the strategy, of course, not exactly as it was in 2018, because a surprise factor was also very important in 2018. But you know, to really be able to build equivalence today, at least enough equivalence to at least encompass again 50% plus one of the electorate. Because, you know, his approval rates is not as bad, actually. It hovers around 30, 40%, even more in some polls. So people are not letting go of him. And I think they only will let go of him when there is a visible face, visible opponent that is convincing. But anyway, I hope until then things get better in this political horizon for 2022.
This was an episode of Impact, Diálogos. In this episode, I spoke with Letícia Cesarino about digital ethnography, populism, Bolsonarism, and conspiracy theories. Impact Diálogos is an original production that is part of the ERC-funded PACT, Populism and Conspiracy Theory Project at the University of Tübingen, Germany. It is written, produced and hosted by me, Katerina Hadzikidi. Sound design and mixing by Ignacio Albornoz Farinha. Special thanks to Steffi da Silva, Yul Ko and Michael Buter. Thank you for listening. See you next time.